end of the 11-11 drill. And let me continue. I think I have a couple more minutes. Firing a perfect spiral about 40 yards down the left sideline, well over connected with receiver Jackson Harper from Simsbury, who did enough toe-tapping and foot-dragging for the catch to be called complete on the field. The offense simulated what would have happened in a real game, getting to the line before anyone could call for a challenge, and fumbled a rush snap. It was a glimpse of what the team hopes is a bright future. Welliver will likely start his career behind the older Joe Fagnano and Tuan Roberson, who are again competing for the starting job, which Fagnano earned after last year's camp. He started two games before suffering a season-ending shoulder injury against Georgia State. Elsewhere on offense, it was running backs Jaden Mel Brown and Darrell Robinson, who stood out alongside former Wisconsin receiver Skylar Bell. Brown, described by new offensive coordinator and former offensive line coach Gordon Samis as a jitterbug, played in a similar offensive system over his two seasons at Gardner-Webb and is an influx of speed and shiftiness in the backfield. Robinson from Charlotte brings more power like returner Cam Edwards, who missed Sunday's practice with turf toe. With Rosa feeling faster and ready to develop as a pass catcher out of the backfield, Moore feels that the running back room is one of the team's strongest areas. Bell, who had 30-plus catches in each of the last two seasons at Wisconsin, joins the receiver room where Brett Buckham, a second-year Husky from Delaware, is prepared to step into the lead role. The Huskies will hit the portal looking for more depth in that area and on the offensive line, where they lost Christian Haynes, a potential NFL draft pick, and center Noel Ofori-Nyadu transferred to Colorado. I think we've done a good job of implementing ourselves as leaders and continuing to grow our room, and not only our room, but the entire team, said right tackle Chase Lunt, readying for his fifth season with the Huskies. And we're going to stop there. That is the end of the sports for today, and I'd like to wish you a very pleasant evening. So long.
Listening to Chris, celebrating 40 years as Connecticut's talking newsstand for the blind and print challenged.
Welcome to tonight's installment of the Regional Roundup on Chris. We invite you to join us for the next hour as we feature the top national, state, and local stories making headlines today.
From the Chris Broadcast Center in Windsor, here is tonight's regional roundup.
Hello, it's Monday, April 22nd, 2024. I'm Arlene Ford, and I'll be reading the front pages of the Hartford Courant and New York Times. Let's begin by taking a look at the photos on the front page of the Hartford Courant. The first photo we see is that of a rabbi packaging shmurmer matzah, and there are stacks of boxes on the right and left as he's doing it, and you see him in his hat and suit that he wears, and in this particular photo he's holding a piece of the matzah as he's getting ready to wrap it and put it in a box. And we'll be doing a story on that later on in the broadcast. And the caption under the photo reads, Rabbi Yosef Walbalski packages shmurma matzah into boxes at the Shabbat Jewish Center in Glastonbury on Thursday. The matzah will be distributed throughout local communities for Passover. The next photo is a headshot of a woman, and she, in this photo, is wearing a mask, and she has dark brown hair, and basically she is trying to fix the problem of the homeless, where they have no place to keep their documents safe. And the caption under her photo reads, "Carrie Howe, founder of a grassroots organization called Night Angels and director of the Soup Kitchen at Center Church in Hartford, is working to meet the needs of unhoused people in Hartford." And we'll be doing a story on that later on in the broadcast. Now for the photos on the front page of the New York Times. The primary photo here is that of, we see three soldiers in an area, and we can see part of their weapons. And the caption under that reads, "Low on ammunition, soldiers in the Donetsk region in March. The aid from the House bill was met with relief in Ukraine." And we'll be doing a story on that later on in the broadcast. Then the next photo is that of a lady named Virginia Soul Smith, and she lives in Cold Spring, New York. And in this particular photo, in the background, we see one of her plants, and then we see her sitting on a sofa. She has wearing glasses. She has dark brown hair. She's wearing a red sweater and dark colored pants. And in the background, you can see some of the decorations in her home. The gist of the story is that she is considered to be a fat activist, and this has to do with Ozempic, where everyone is using that to lose weight. And the caption under her photo reads, "The fat activist Virginia Soul Smith at home in Cold Spring, New York, where there are no food rules." And we definitely will be doing a story on that later on in the broadcast. The next photo we see is a headshot of Speaker Mike Johnson after a $95 billion package was passed. Let's begin with the lead story of the day titled, "Passover in a Year of Pain." Setting an extra chair at the cedar table to represent hostages taken by Hamas. In a difficult time for Jews around the world, there will be an extra chair at many Connecticut Passover seders this year. The extra chairs will be set out to represent the Israeli and foreign national hostages held by Hamas in Gaza since the October 7th attack on Israel. At heart, this Passover story is a story about how we went from slavery and bondage to freedom, said Rabbi Michael Pincus of Congregation Beth Israel in West Hartford. "That's the story we tell every year. We will end with that line next year in Jerusalem. It's been a particularly hard year, obviously," he said. "I know many people, including myself, will have a chair at our table for the hostages. The chair will mark all the hostages who have families who will have an empty chair in their home and pray for their safe return," Pincus said. Passover, which marks the escape of the Israelites from slavery under the Egyptians, as told in the book of Exodus, begins at sundown on Monday. Pincus will make another symbolic gesture. According to the Haggadah, which describes the order of the Seder meal, at one point 10 drops of wine are dropped into the cup as the 10 plagues God sent down on Egypt are named. And there's a very old rabbinic teaching that says that when the Israelites were rejoicing that they had escaped Egypt, their joy was diminished because of the suffering of the Egyptians who drowned in the sea, Pincus said. "I'll take 10 drops from my cup to mark the suffering of those who have been caught up in this war," he said, referring to the more than 30,000 Palestinians who have died in the Israel-Hamas war. He added that the word Seder in Hebrew means order, and I think that in some ways the whole message of the Seder is, how do we try to make order in a world that is so out out of order. The story, I think, helps us to give some order for us, and hopefully it'll make our world a little more order in our world. Rabbi Yosef Wolwalski of the Shabbat Jewish Center in Glastonbury also will have extra seats at the Community Seder. We are adding spots that we're offering to people to attend for free in honor of the hostages, he said. So we believe very strongly that the way to honor those who are suffering is by doing more good. And that creates more good energy in general, which should have been blessings, particularly to those who need it the most, which are those who are hostages. Wolwalski has been busy for the last month, along with other Shabbat organizations, preparing and delivering packages of special matzahs imported from Israel. It's dramatically expanded this year, he said of the operation. Basically, we want as many people as possible, not only to celebrate individually, but to celebrate with family and friends and to have as authentic a Passover experience that they could have. The matzahs are hand-baked in Israel, which makes them round as opposed to square factory-made bread. It's called shmurah, he said. Shmurah literally means guarded, which means that it's supervised all the way from the wheat in the field until its final product to be distributed. So it's under supervision all the time for months. And this is all happening in Israel. Then we import it here and we deliver it to local homes and businesses for the month before Passover. The Glastonbury Shabbat is preparing 450 packets. Thousands will be sent out statewide, Wolwalski said, for 23 community seders at centers and college campuses. While the matzahs are expensive, I try to reimagine the word expensive as valuable because it is truly valuable, he said. You should see the faces of people who receive it by hand, both from myself personally and from volunteers, he said. People really feel elevated and connected. It brings the community together. Likely, UK Foreign Secretary has many U.S. ties. A friend of Democrats is expanding his roster to reach Trump's allies, and this is out of London. Few British politicians have American ties as deep as those of David Lammy, who is set to become Britain's foreign secretary if the opposition Labour Party wins the coming election, as the polls suggest it will. A son of Guyanese immigrants who grew up poor in working-class London, he spent summers with relatives in Brooklyn and Queens, working at Consolidated Edison before earning a master's degree at Harvard Law School and befriending Barack Obama, for whom he canvassed in Chicago during his first presidential campaign. Yet now, on the cusp of becoming Britain's chief diplomat, Mr. Lammy finds himself facing an uncertain, even potentially hostile, American political landscape. President Biden and the Democrats with whom Mr. Lammy has cultivated a deep network of contacts are fighting to hold off a resurgent Donald J. Trump. Having been chosen by the Labour leader Keir Starmer partly because of his transatlantic credentials, Mr. Lammy, 51, is scrambling to build ties with Republicans and, more challengingly, with those around Mr. Trump. It's a very different American establishment from the Democratic one he knows so well. Would Mr. Lammy pay a visit to Mar-a-Lago, Mr. Trump's Palm Beach estate, as David Cameron, Britain's current foreign secretary, did 2 weeks ago to lobby the former president on military aid to Ukraine? Of course, he said in an interview last week in Portcullis House, the parliamentary office building across the street from Big Ben. Noting that he was headed soon to New York and Washington, he said, "I'm happy to talk to whomever the American people decide they want to run the country." That's a time-tested answer for any foreign politician during an American election year, especially one from a party that has held a double-digit polling lead over the governing conservatives for 18 months. But unlike many Europeans who regard Mr. Trump with a mix of fear and bemusement, Mr. Lammy genuinely seems to believe he can find common ground with those in Mr. Trump's orbit. He has held meetings with former Trump officials like Mike Pompeo, who served as Secretary of State and CIA Director, and Robert C. O'Brien, who was Mr. Trump's last national security advisor. And he has struck up a relationship with Senator J.D. Vance, the Ohio Republican and enthusiastic Trump convert. The challenge for Mr. Lammy is that he shares more with Mr. Obama, who was a few years ahead of him at Harvard, the two men who met 20 years ago at a gathering for black alumni, had dinner when Mr. Obama visited London last month. In Mr. Obama's Washington office hangs a portrait of the former president made by Mr. Lammy's wife, Nicola Green, an artist who chronicled his 2008 campaign. One of Mr. Obama's former advisors, Benjamin J. Rhodes, introduced Mr. Lammy to other Democratic lawmakers and has also become a friend. In the event of a Labor government and a second Biden administration, he predicted, you would see a much more aligned U.S. and U.K. relationship. But Mr. Rhodes said Mr. Lammy's gregarious manner and pragmatic politics would give him at least a fighting chance with a Trump administration. I think he believes that through force of personality, he could develop relationships in that circle, Mr. Rhodes said. For now, Mr. Lammy is determined not to offend. Asked about Mr. Trump's recent statement that he would tell the Russians to do, quote, whatever the hell they want, end quote, to any NATO member that did not pay its fair share of the alliance's costs, Mr. Lammy seized on the reference to burden sharing. Is Donald Trump right, he said, 100%. Too many NATO countries, Mr. Lammy said, still fail to meet the alliance's target of military spending equal to 2% of gross domestic product. Britain spends roughly 2.2%. The Labour Party has vowed to raise that to 2.5%, and Mr. Lammy accused the Conservative of bleeding Britain's armed forces down to a size they had not seen since the Napoleonic era. Israeli strikes on Rafah kill 22 as U.S. funds near. Netanyahu vows to step up painful pressure on Hamas. This is out of Rafah on the Gaza Strip. Israeli strikes on the southern Gaza city of Rafah overnight killed 22 people, including 18 children, health officials said Sunday, as the United States was on track to approve billions of dollars of additional military aid to Israel, its close ally. Israel has carried out near-daily air raids on Rafah, where more than half of Gaza's population of 2.3 million has sought refuge from fighting elsewhere. It has also vowed to expand its ground offensive against Hamas to the city on the border with Egypt, despite calls for restraint, including from the U.S. In the coming days, we will increase the political and military pressure on Hamas because this is the only way to bring back our hostages and achieve victory. We will land more and painful blows on Hamas soon, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said in a statement. The Israel-Hamas war has killed more than 34,000 Palestinians, according to local health officials, at least two-thirds of them children and women. It has devastated Gaza's two largest cities and left a swath of destruction. Around 80% of the territory's population have fled to other parts of the besieged coastal enclave. The $26 billion aid package approved Saturday by the U.S. House includes $9 billion in humanitarian assistance for Gaza, which experts say is on the brink of famine. The Senate could pass the package as soon as Tuesday, and President Joe Biden has promised to sign it immediately. The conflict in its 7 months has sparked regional unrest. Israel and Iran traded fire directly this month, raising fears of all-out war. Tensions also have spiked in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. Israeli troops killed two Palestinians who the military says attacked a checkpoint early Sunday using a knife and a gun near the southern West Bank town of Hebron. The Palestinian Red Crescent Rescue Service said it had recovered 14 bodies from an Israeli raid that began late Thursday in the Nur Shams urban refugee camp in the West Bank. Those killed included three militants from Islamic Jihad and a 15-year-old boy. The military said it killed 14 militants and arrested eight suspects. 10 Israeli soldiers and one border police officer were wounded. In a separate incident in the West Bank, an Israeli man was wounded in an explosion Sunday, the Magen David Adam Rescue Service said. A video online shows a man approaching a Palestinian flag planted in a field. When he kicks it, it appears to trigger an explosive device. At least 469 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli soldiers and settlers in the West Bank since the start of the Israel-Hamas war, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry. Word of renewed U.S. assistance is met with joy and relief in Ukraine. This is out of Kiev. The Ukrainian lieutenant was at a firing position on the Eastern Front, commanding an artillery unit, relying on American-provided M777 howitzers and other big guns as U.S. lawmakers gathered in Washington to decide if his cannons would be forced to go silent for lack of ammunition. But when the lieutenant returned to his base on Saturday night, he got the news that he and millions of Ukrainians had been praying to hear. "I had just entered the building after a shift change when the guys informed me that the aid package for Ukraine had finally been approved by Congress," said the lieutenant, who was identified only by his first name, Oleksandr, and in line with military protocol. "We hope this aid package will reach us as soon as possible." The decision by American lawmakers to resume military assistance after months of costly delay was greeted with a collective sigh of relief and an outpouring of gratitude across a battered and bloodied Ukraine. "It may have been late in coming," soldiers and civilians said, "but American support meant more than bullets and bombs. It offered something equally important: hope." Immediately after the vote passed in Congress, Ukrainian citizens took to social media to offer thanks and express joy, posting American flag memes blending Ukrainian imagery with American symbols like the Statue of Liberty. "I have tears in my eyes," Anton Gerashenko, the founder of the Ukrainian Institute for the Future, a research group, said in a message. "So much suffering, so much pain, so many lost friends and wonderful people in these horrible years of war. Now there is hope to save more lives of those who are still alive." The $60 billion military assistance package approved by the House is expected to be voted on by the Senate and signed by President Biden as early as Tuesday. We'll continue with more of Front Pages for Monday, April 22nd, 2024, after the check of the national and local forecast. National forecast. A storm will begin to move into the northern plains today, bringing showers across the region as well as the northern Rockies. Thunderstorms will develop in the Florida Peninsula as a cold front travels southward through the state. Some thunderstorms will become strong, capable of producing hail and damaging winds. Farther north, any rain lingering along the Atlantic coast from North Carolina to Georgia will quickly end in the morning. The rest of the nation will experience largely dry conditions, with the exception of showers in southern Texas. Very warm weather will continue across the interior. Southwest as a zone of high pressure remains over the region. Additionally, temperatures will begin to trend higher than previous days across the east. And now for your local forecast.
The top stories from USA Today are on Chris, weekdays at 3.
The forecast for tonight is clear, with a low around 34. Tomorrow, Tuesday, will be sunny, with a high near 65. And tomorrow night, there's a chance of showers with increasing clouds and a low around 41. Wednesday, showers are likely and possibly a thunderstorm. It'll be mostly cloudy, with a high near 62. And Wednesday night, there's a chance of showers, partly cloudy, with a low around 30. Thursday will be sunny, with a high near 57. And Thursday night, mostly clear, with a low around 31. Have a good evening. Thank you for listening to Chris.
Welcome back to Front Pages for Monday, April 22nd, 2024. Our next story is titled, Ghost Kitchens Have Been Vanishing. Delivery-only operations grew during the pandemic. Now dealing with rising demand and complaints from customers, food businesses are rethinking their strategy. On a recent afternoon, the kitchen inside a Denny's in the Jackson Heights neighborhood of Queens was bustling. Employees placed burger patties on a grill and pulled fries out of the vat of hot oil. Some orders were whisked away to customers sitting in booths, while others were boxed and set aside for pickup. The takeout orders were mostly from the Denny's menu, but some were from the Burger Den and the Meltdown, two delivery-only brands that the chain owns. The strategy of maximizing kitchen resources blossomed during the COVID pandemic when restrictions shut down indoor dining and customers ate more meals at home. As their kitchens sat idle, many restaurants across the country, desperate for revenue, switched to delivery mode. The result was an explosion in the growth of the so-called ghost kitchen and its close cousin, the virtual brand, or a restaurant that has no physical space and operates online only. Seemingly overnight, catering venues and restaurants alike turned into ghost kitchens, offering foods and meals for delivery only. At the same time, celebrities, influencers, and others created their own virtual brands. Mariah Carey offered cookies, George Lopez put his name on tacos, and Wiz Khalifa's menu included bowls of chicken nuggets over macaroni and cheese. Investors plowed billions of dollars into the space, and startups and established companies made plans to expand. Some Kroger stores had ghost kitchens, and Wendy's announced plans in 2021 to open 700 delivery-only locations. That year, the commercial real estate company CBRE predicted that ghost kitchens would account for 21% of restaurant sales by 2025. But as the pandemic subsided and customers returned to dining inside restaurants, large chains found themselves squeezed by overtaxed kitchens and rising customer complaints, forcing them to reconsider their delivery-only strategy. Wendy's has pulled back from its plans, and Kroger shut down its ghost kitchens last year. Consumers are going out to eat at restaurants again and craving that relationship with the brands themselves, said Dorothy Kalba, a senior research analyst for food service at Euromonitor International. Virtual brands just did not have that connection with consumers. Everyone thought if you have the labor and the equipment, it would be easy to run virtual brands, but the reality is most of the delivery times for virtual brands transact during busy hours for the regular restaurant, said Kevin Hockman, Brinker's chief executive. It was too much to have a busy dinner rush with an influx of virtual orders coming in too. But an influx of orders during the dinner rush is not the only challenge restaurant chains face. Customers using delivery apps like Uber Eats and DoorDash find themselves sometimes wondering where the food is being made, as well as dealing with long wait times as drivers have to deliver multiple orders at a time. This leads to food quality issues. Uber Eats removed 8,000 storefronts from its listings last year over complaints of poor quality, inaccurate orders, or duplication, meaning multiple nearly identical restaurants were operating out of the same location. But restaurants say one of the lessons learned during the pandemic is to stick with what they know. Pizza restaurants should not start making burgers and vice versa, they say. During the pandemic, Chuck E. Cheese created Pasquale's Pizza and Wings, a virtual restaurant that was featured on delivery apps like Grubhub and DoorDash, and offered more grown-up versions of the pizza served for children's birthday parties in the restaurant. We were in the pizza business already, so we're not serving something that's foreign to our kitchens, said David McKillops, the chief executive of Chuck E. Cheese. It's in our DNA. The delivery-only business has slowed as diners have headed back for stuffed crust pizzas and skee-ball, and some of the favorite Pasquale's pizza are now on the Chuck E. Cheese menus, Mr. McKillops said. And still some chains are embracing their virtual brands, continuing to operate and in some cases expanding their offerings. Most of our restaurants are open 24/7, so we have a unique opportunity with our capacity to handle customer orders at different times, said Kelly Belay, the president and chief executive of Denny's, which is testing a third virtual brand, Vanda Burrito. Moreover, most customers ordering from the Burger Den and the Meltdown are younger, in contrast to the typically older crowd that dines at Denny's restaurants. If you're getting a different consumer to eat your burgers, why not lean in, Ms. Vallad said. Manischewitz rebrands to court a new generation. This is out of Bayonne, New Jersey. Something wasn't quite right about the chicken soup. The team at Manischewitz had gathered in the test kitchen at the company's headquarters in Bayonne, New Jersey last year to taste the latest version of one of their new offerings. But it wasn't hitting the notes they were aiming for. We were tasting it against our grandparents and saying, no, that's not it. It's just not like our Friday night chicken soup, said Shaney Seidman, the chief marketing officer for Keiko, which owns Manischewitz. More vegetables, more chicken, a little salt. A lot of times you think of improvement and innovation as extra or modern, Ms. Seidman said in an interview this month, but we're going back to go forward. And chicken soup is only the start of it. Would your boobie like a side of merch with that gefilte fish? Manischewitz, 136-year-old brand that has been a staple in American Jewish households for generations, is looking to go beyond Passover, which begins on Monday evening, with a top-to-bottom rebranding and an expansion of its product range. Cans are out. Reusable bags are in. New products include grapeseed oil, frozen gluten-free knishes, and frozen matzo balls. Don't tell your mother. There is a new brand identity with a color palette that leans heavily on the company's signature orange, meant to evoke the appearance of its matzo ball soup. It includes a custom typeface with Hebrew-inspired details, Yiddishisms, there's bupkis like it, and whimsical doodled characters reminiscent of Jewish cookbook and prayer books from the 1950s that are meant to invite everyone into the tent. The idea, Ms. Seidman said, is not just to target culturally curious gourmands. It is also an attempt to tee up a new generation of hosts, millennials. When you host someone, you want to give them wholesome foods, things that you would cook, she said. We want to provide the next generation of consumers food they'd be proud to serve. In doing so, Manischewitz faces the difficult balancing act of preserving its legacy as a trusted brand and the most recognizable name in Jewish food, while dusting off a reputation that even its top executives acknowledge had become, well, dusty. Amanda Dell, the Vice President of Programs and Communications at the Jewish Food Society, said that many Jews connect to their cultural identity through the meals they share with their families. My hope, she added, is that this rebrand can instill a new sense of pride in Jewish food. Manischewitz was founded in 1888 by Rabbi Dov Baer Manischewitz, a Prussian immigrant who scaled a small matzah bakery in Cincinnati into a large standardized operation with a gas-fired oven and mechanized conveyor belt system. Manischewitz became a household name among American Jews, and by 1990, when the company was sold to a private equity firm, it controlled 80% of the matzah market in the United States. Keiko, whose holdings include Saber, Fox's, You Bet, and Kadem, is among the largest kosher food distributors in the United States. When it bought Manischewitz in 2019, it was seen in the kosher world as the equivalent of General Motors acquiring Ford. To us, we always looked up to Manischewitz as this legacy brand, which had so much history in it, said Charles Herzog, the president of Keiko, which was founded in 1848. It is now 30 minutes after the hour. We will return with more Morning Front Pages for April 22nd, 2024, after these messages.
Windsor's Connecticut Valley Tobacco Museum, with the help of the Windsor Lions Club and Chris Radio, has set up 18 Chris Access readers describing various exhibits for low vision and print disabled individuals. With input from the low vision population and working with a teacher of low vision and print disabled individuals, we have also improved the accessibility of these readers with highly visible markers on the floor. To access the QR code, just open the camera option on your phone, scan the QR code, and press enter once the link is shown. Please be aware that cell phone coverage in Northwest Park, where the Tobacco Museum is located, is limited, so please stop by the archive building to get the Wi-Fi password. If you or someone you know are interested in using this unique feature, please call the Tobacco Museum at 860-285-1888 or email windsorconnecticutmuseum@gmail.com. The Connecticut Valley Tobacco Museum is located in Windsor's Northwest Park, 135 Lang Road, and is open Fridays and Saturdays, noon to 4 p.m. through the last week of October.
Welcome back to Morning Front Pages for April 22nd, 2024. Our next story, after spiral, she found sanctuary. Studio owner used yoga to heal and is now sharing it. Stephanie Wheelahan changes lives through yoga as she did her own life after the grip of postpartum depression led to alcohol abuse. I have a deeper capacity to deal with life and stress, said Wheelahan, sober for more than 2 years. I have the capacity to get through life feeling grounded through life's happenings. Since the yoga created such a large shift in my life, Wheelahan said, she became a trained instructor to help others and recently opened Nourished Roots Yoga at 34 Main Street in Thomaston. Whether it's relief from trauma, anxiety, or everyday stress that clients are seeking, or just overall wellness or physical changes, Wheelahan said her team of 7 instructors have just the right remedy. Wheelahan, by all accounts a gifted teacher, has created a warm, inviting space reflective of her personality, they say. Nourished Roots Yoga cultivates an environment where growth and connection thrive. It's not just about attending classes. It's about embracing a deeper practice than what you may find elsewhere, said client Sarah Simino. Each class and instructor serve a unique purpose. Stephanie has created a sanctuary for mindful movement. She is the guiding force behind this space and has crafted a one-of-a-kind environment that feels like home. Student Nicole Iannello said Wheelahan taught the first formal yoga class she ever took, and the impact was powerful. It was serene and beautiful, and at the end, she went up to each student to chat and ask how they felt, Iannello said. Stephanie's care and ability to connect with people creates a comforting environment. Stephanie has created a studio that mirrors herself. It's a warm, inviting, and comfortable space for all people to practice. Yoga is an ancient and complex mind and body spiritual practice that can build strength, structure, and stability, Wheelahan said. It's become a popular way of promoting overall wellness physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually, Wheelahan said. Mentally and emotionally, it helps you bring into center. You're focusing on what you're doing in the moment. It can result in better health choices and better sleep. Wheelahan, a mom of 2 boys, 8 and 5, said she overcame alcohol abuse through yoga. Wheelahan said while suffering postpartum depression after giving birth to her first son, the downward spiral began. She knew she needed an outlet, but workouts at the gym didn't satisfy me. I was really struggling mentally with alcohol abuse, she said. I was just a mess. I was not well. She turned to yoga and, in her case, didn't use programs such as Alcoholics Anonymous or others. Wheelahan said she has been sober for more than 2 years. A year into sobriety, she studied more about yoga for recovery, and it led her to a program called Y12, which stands for Yoga for the 12 Steps of Recovery. Wheelahan became a trained instructor in that approach and plans to offer it at Nourish Roots in the fall. Long Wharf puts out lineup. New Haven Theater season to include plays and virtual fest. New Haven's Long Wharf Theater has announced its 2024-25 season. The 60th anniversary season will include 3 live in-person productions, plus the return of an online short play festival and an artistic congress. The company is continuing its transition to a new way of working. 2 years ago, the Long Wharf Theater, which had been based for 57 years in its own space among the loading docks on Sargent Drive, was changed by its board of directors into an itinerant theater company producing shows at a variety of different locations in and around New Haven. The 2024-25 season includes She Loves Me, directed by Ped Padron, from November 30th through December 15th at the Lab at Concord in Hamden. The musical by Jerry Bock, Sheldon Harnick, and Joe Mastroff is based on the same 1937 play, Parfumery, that inspired the romantic films The Little Shop Around the Corner and You've Got Mail. Calling it a holiday show, The Long Wharf promises a fresh interpretation in an intimate setting where audiences will feel like part of the story. She Loves Me marks the first full production that Padron has directed for the Long Wharf Theater. Padron co-directed the current show as TheaterWorks Hartford, the immigration drama Sanctuary City. El Coqui Espectacular and The Bottle of Doom by Matt Barbo, directed by Keenan Valdez, from January 25, 25 through February 16, 2025 at Southern Connecticut State University's Lyman Center. The Long Wharf Theater will perform this play about a comic book artist who dresses up as the Puerto Rican superhero he's created on a conventional stage at SCSU, whose theater department has an ongoing partnership with the theater company. Unbecoming Tragedy, a ritual journey toward destiny, written and performed by Terrence Riggins and directed by Cheyenne Barboza, from May 16, 2025 to June 8, 2025, will be presented in collaboration with New Haven's Collective Consciousness Theater at Yale's Off-Broadway Theater. The one-person show was workshopped this year at the Brigamos Theater in New Haven. The Long Wharf is also hosting an artistic congress on October 25th through the 27th at Yale University's Schwarzman Center. The event is described as a discussion about why theater is essential to a thriving democracy, as well as a gathering space for artists, scholars, and neighbors, and a networking opportunity for those who work in the theater. The Long Wharf's annual virtual new play festival, Black Trans Women as the Center, will also return with the dates yet to be announced in November. The 2023-24 Long Wharf season offered 3 full productions, an intimate staging of The Year of Magical Thinking, staged in private homes and libraries, the Arthur Miller drama, A View from the Bridge, produced at the Canal Dock Boathouse overlooking the New Haven Harbor, and the upcoming Am I Gone, and Am is A-M-M, created and performed by Adil Mansour, May 28 through June 23rd. For more details on the Long Wharf's 2024-25 season, are at the theater's website at longwharf.org. In the age of Ozempic, she's fighting for the freedom to be fat. The sheet pan chicken and roasted broccoli are out of the oven and white rice is steaming on the stove. Virginia Soule Smith, who has spent a decade writing about how women think and feel about their bodies and how they pass along those feelings to their children through food, is about to serve dinner to her daughters, Violet 10 and Beatrix 6. Soule Smith tries not to be a short order cook. Respect the labor is how she puts it, reminding her children that if they don't like what she has prepared, there's other stuff to eat in the house. A pull-out shelf in the pantry holds Tate's chocolate chip cookies, goldfish crackers, pea snaps, and chocolate kisses. There are raspberries and grape tomatoes in the fridge. What Sol Smith hopes to model, she said in a five-hour interview at her home in Cold Spring, New York, is that you can be a mom who doesn't live solely in service of other people, that you deserve time to yourself, and that you're a person with needs, that those needs matter. She ferries the girls' plastic plates to the front porch table, evading the miniature Bernedoodle, Penelope. A year ago, Sol Smith published Fat Talk, Parenting in the Age of Diet Culture, a guide to helping parents grapple with their discomfort and anxiety about weight and food. At the moment when Ozempic-like drugs are enabling people to become thin, Sol Smith has become one of the country's most visible fat activists, calling out the bias and discrimination faced by people in bigger bodies, especially from doctors and research scientists. She asserts her own right to be fat, the preferred adjective in her corner of the internet. In Sol Smith's house, there are neither good or bad foods, nor healthy or unhealthy ones. Donuts and kale hold equivalent moral value, and no one polices portion size. By relieving herself and her family of rules about eating, Sol Smith believes she will have a better chance of raising children who are proud of their bodies, trust themselves to enjoy their food, and leave the table when they're full. She serves dessert and snacks like Cheez-Its. Along with the dinner entree, her kids can eat their meal in any order. Fat Talk is, in a way, Sol Smith's manifesto of liberation from what nutritionists call diet culture, the enormous pressure American women in particular feel to be thin and to raise thin children. For many years, she covered health, including for the New York Times, and her reporting on the pursuit of thinness prompted her rejection of it. For Sol Smith, diet culture has come to symbolize all the crushing expectations under which American women live. In her Substack newsletter and podcast, Burnt Toast, she muses on whether hewing to a household budget, gardening only with native plants, or limiting kids' screen time can be regarded as diets. Sol Smith separated from her husband Dan Upham last June, and in that upheaval has had to reconsider many family rituals, including dinner. Sol Smith and Upham attempted a regular dinner hour. Upham said he considered it sacrosanct, but when they split, neither child wanted to come to the table at all. And then Sol Smith hit on a fix. She released her kids from the pressure to politely converse by allowing them to read at the table. Sol Smith has emerged as an inspirational, infuriating voice on the subject of bodies at a moment when there is no neutral zone. Since Fat Talk became a New York Times bestseller last May, Burnt Toast has grown to nearly 50,000 subscribers, mostly white, straight, millennial mothers who have struggled with eating, body image, and weight. In Sol Smith's reader survey, about half of her audience identified as fat. On Burnt Toast, no pro-weight loss comments are allowed. Officials crack down on rise of temp tags stoked by pandemic. After hearing complaints about streets filled with cars with expired temporary license tags, the mayor of St. Charles, Missouri, invited his constituents to send in photos of bad plates. He received more than 4,100 in a year from a city of about 71,000 people. A Washington, D.C. council member wants to make it easier for officials to tow cars with expired tags, saying the proliferation of them makes my community members crazy. Texas will soon require dealerships to issue temporary metal plates when a car rolls off the lot, replacing the oft-abused paper tags. The crackdown on temp tags comes in response to a problem that officials say has festered for years but exploded during the COVID-19 pandemic alongside other chaos on American roads. Fatalities from car crashes rose while pedestrian deaths in 2021 reached their highest level since the early 1980s. Such deaths have declined slightly but remained well above pre-pandemic levels last year. The rise in fake or expired plates has been robbing governments of needed revenue and making it harder to enforce traffic laws, which the American driver seems more emboldened than ever to ignore, part of a larger erosion of social mores. From what I am seeing, there is a real breakdown in automotive law and order, said Dan Borgmeyer, the St. Charles mayor, who urged citizens to report expired tags in his St. Louis suburb. The shuttering of government offices during the pandemic caused disruptions and delays in routine bureaucratic functions like processing car registrations, and many states extended deadlines. At the same time, police departments reduced or halted traffic stops for minor offenses because of staffing shortages and the intense scrutiny after George Floyd's murder in May 2020. This is one aspect of a much larger problem, said Jonathan Adkins, chief executive of the Governor's Highway Safety Association. We are giving the public too much permission to flout rules. Temporary tags have been involved in a spate of deadly crashes and violent crimes. Mayor Eric Adams of New York City, where 16 traffic-related deaths in 2021 involved vehicles with temporary license plates, said cars with fake tags had become a weapon of death for our innocent New Yorkers. Some of the thousands of photos that the St. Charles mayor received from residents were forwarded to the police. Many cars were just passing through, but when the cars of St. Charles residents were identified, officers went to many of the home addresses associated with the temporary tag and issued a ticket. Mayor Borgmeyer did his part, too. One day he pulled up behind a car with expired temporary plates and snapped a picture with his phone. The driver rolled down his window and extended his middle finger. Mr. Borgmeyer sent the photo to the police, but by the time officers followed up, the driver had already started the process of obtaining a proper license plate. Morning Front Pages for April 22, 2024 will return after these brief messages.
People with diabetes can develop many different foot problems, so being proactive in protecting your feet can go a long way in avoiding any serious complications. Here are some foot care tips from the American Diabetes Association. Check your feet daily for sores, cuts, cracks, blisters, or redness. Use a mirror to see all of your foot. Wear socks. Try to choose socks that have some padding if you need more cushion on the bottom of your feet, are made of a synthetic fabric or wool to wick away any moisture, fit well and aren't too tight, and are white or light colored to make it easy to spot any bleeding or drainage. Get fitted for the right footwear and wear shoes indoors and out. Don't put shoes on without socks. In warmer months, refrain from going barefoot, wearing flip-flops, or open shoes. Ask your provider about compression socks or stockings. Wash your feet with warm, not hot, soapy water and be sure to dry between your toes. Keep toenails trimmed. When buying diabetes-related foot products, look for the American Podiatrist Medical Association, APMA, seal of approval, which means they promote good foot health. Keep up with regular foot care visits and exams, and be sure your health care providers are on the same page. This message was brought to you by the American Diabetes Association in cooperation with CRIS, Connecticut's Talking Newsstand.
Welcome back to Morning Front Pages for April 22nd, 2024. Our next story, lockers aim to fix an overlooked problem. Woman says homeless often lack safe place to put their documents. Carrie Howe has been on a decades-long mission to give back. A self-described altruist, she has helped thousands of people in Hartford get housing, get out of the cold, and enjoy a warm meal. During a cold night in the city in 2011, Howe and some friends were called Angels of the Night after giving a homeless man wearing only a t-shirt some warm clothes and food. The phrase stuck, and so did her passion for helping others. Howe, who started the grassroots organization Night Angels in 2011, has worked for the First Church of Christ Center Church in Hartford for the last 6 years, heading its community meal and outreach programs. We stayed open all through the pandemic. We never closed, Hal said. The only time we closed is when I actually got COVID myself and ended up in the hospital for over a month. We were, for a long time, the only place still open. Hal, who had a brush with death during a bout with COVID-19 in 2021, said her passion for helping others comes from wanting to connect people. When I was younger, I enjoyed finding solutions. I wanted to connect people to solve things, Hal said. My drive now is really based off the fact that after years of serving, I'm one person who has a lot of information. Maybe not all the information, but I'm able to share that with people and help people gain access to resources. That's my motivation now. Call me a hippie, but I really think we can solve a lot by connecting people together. It's not a dream or thought. It actually works. Hal, who is in the process of creating a nonprofit called The Space Between, volunteers on an almost full-time basis outside of her day job with the church. Last December, Hal opened a warming center during the freezing winter months as the city turned people away due to lack of beds. From midnight to 5:30 a.m., 7 days a week, the volunteer-run center served as a refuge for members of the unsheltered community with nowhere else to go. In the first week, Hal said the warming center served over 150 individuals, according to a previous current article. The youngest guests were a 20-year-old with a 1-year-old baby. While many awaited shelter, she connected some to job training resources and opportunities. Hal recently purchased 24 individual lockers to solve a problem she said she hears all too often. I've witnessed people who haven't had an ID, a birth certificate, or social security card. Because of that, they can't apply for housing, get a job, or start addiction treatment, Hal said. One of the biggest problems for the homeless is not having a place to store stuff. A lot of times, things get stolen or lost. So I started this locker idea for people to store their documents they need to keep themselves safe. Hal said that each locker will have around 10 small plastic containers so that multiple people can use an individual locker for their documents. She estimates over 200 people can store their documents in the lockers. You can't work if you have an addiction, but you can't get treatment if you don't have an ID, Hal said. I have one individual who does not have his ID, so he can't get a job he applied for. Another individual lost theirs and is unable to get treatment. It's such a simple fix. People just need a safe place to put their documents. Hal said next Sunday she is inviting community members to come and paint the lockers in the basement of Center Church. It's spring, time to feed the plants in Connecticut. Here's what to know. Plants need nutrients to grow and develop just like we need vitamins and minerals. They get most of their nutrients dissolved in the water they take up with their roots. When we add fertilizer to the soil around our garden plants, we are adding vital plant nutrients. Native Connecticut soils are typically low in pH and low in nutrients. Our native plants have adapted to our native soils, but most of our garden plants are not from around here. Zinnias and tomatoes are from South America, bluegrass lawns and lilacs hail from Europe, and rhododendrons from Asia. Our native soils may not supply the nutrients they need, so it is up to us to do so. Of course, the best way to know which nutrients and how much to add is with a soil test. April is a very busy month at the Yukon Soil Nutrient Analysis Lab. But there is still time to get your soil tested before planting. Without soil test recommendations, always follow the directions on the fertilizer package. Applying too much can injure your plants, plus excessive nitrogen and phosphorus can wind up in our waterways. Before fertilizing, calculate out the square footage of your garden or lawn. You don't need to measure exactly. You can measure a pace and then walk down the length and across the width of your garden to get a rough estimate of area. For odd-shaped beds or lawns, break them down into more square, oval, or rectangular areas and add them up. All fertilizers come with three numbers on the package denoting the percent on a dry weight basis of nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. Nitrogen promotes green leafy growth, phosphorus encourages fruits and roots, and potassium is for all-round health and tolerance to stresses like drought, cold, and disease. So fertilizers with a higher nitrogen number would be most appropriate for turf, grasses, trees, and shrubs, while ones higher in phosphorus are generally used in vegetable and flower gardens. Whether you select a synthetic or natural organic fertilizer is a matter of personal choice. Both are beneficial to plants. For annual plantings, whether vegetable or flowers, it would be ideal to mix the fertilizer into the top 6 inches of soil. That's where most of the roots will be, so it makes sense that the nutrients they need are there too. Put down the fertilizer as well as any limestone or other amendments shortly before planting. Long-season annuals like tomatoes, pumpkins, and marigolds would appreciate a second application of fertilizer, referred to as side dressing, about 2 months after the first one. As you are cleaning up your perennial beds and see the new shoots popping through the soil, add some fertilizer around plants and carefully scratch it in. Do the same for bulbs. It is harder to fertilize if the beds are heavily mulched. Not much fertilizer spread on top of mulch will make it to the plant roots. Rake or pull away the mulch. Sprinkle some fertilizer directly to the soil around your plants and replace the mulch. For trees and shrubs, fertilizer should be spread under the whole canopy, as a healthy root system will grow at least as wide as the branches and perhaps even more so. Do your best to remove the mulch before fertilizing. Typically, trees and shrubs are fertilized once a year in the spring. Once they have reached their mature